We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
What we believe about the Bible is based on what we believe about its source.
The God Who Speaks, the award-winning documentary from the American Family Association, is now available in a special limited edition DVD set. This release includes a Sunday school curriculum and 2 hours of additional footage. Go to thegodwhospeaks.org to get your copy today. thegodwhospeaks.org. Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, it is Wednesday, October 2nd, and we actually had a really nice debate last night. I was really shocked that it exceeded expectations, but I mean, when your expectations are basically on the floor or the bar is like 1 millimeter high, it's really not that hard. But compared to the presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris and the barbs back and forth, and I think what we've come to expect, even the Republican primary debates where it was a bunch of, you know, pot shots going back and forth and everybody looking for a viral moment, this was a lot more substantive, and there actually seemed to be genuine respect between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, and in a good way. Even though ultimately I think everybody, even Democrats, even though they don't really want to admit it, everybody said that J.D. Vance very clearly won. He was solid. He was very prepared. He shines in this type of format. We saw that during his Ohio Senate campaign. And I think that that's one of the main reasons, among others, but one of the main reasons that Donald Trump chose him to be his running mate. And Tim Walz started off really shaky, kind of nervous, was saying a lot, was forgetting some of the key words in some of his clearly more prepared responses in the beginning. But he got his feet under him pretty quickly. And even though, of course, I personally disagreed with a lot of the responses in terms of content and policy, and Tim Walz ended with saying that Kamala Harris's campaign is running on joy and, you know, the vibes, which was utterly ridiculous, he still at least had a much more solid performance than Kamala Harris did. In fact, a lot of the comments, even from friends and family members who were texting me, but also on social media and some of the other you know, just networks and outlets that I saw in terms of the response, a lot of people were saying, can we just kind of get rid of the top of the ticket and go to kind of the next wave and maybe the future that harkens back a little bit to when some of these debates weren't so contentious, and we actually had what seemed to be like two very respectable people that were standing on the stage. So in that way, I was actually impressed with the way that the whole debate was conducted. The moderators, of course, were very annoying, per the usual. CBS, the two anchors that were moderating, did insert themselves a couple of times. One time, they actually muted J.D. Vance's microphone, which was a little bit ridiculous because he was trying to respond to CBS fact-checking him, which they had said up front that they were not going to do. So CBS broke their own rules, and they just could not help themselves. And so J.D. Vance very wisely said, well, hang on a minute. Since you're going to fact-check me, let me go back and talk about this. And I think it was over the whole immigration statistics, if I'm recalling that right. And they ended up muting his microphone and then just saying, we need to move on. And when candidates go back and forth, and there were a couple of really good exchanges between Walz and Vance, and they were actually interacting on a couple of policy issues, not in a just, you know, fighting way or some of these, you know, ridiculous kind of nonsensical pot shots. Again, they were actually debating back and forth. If you're a solid moderator and you don't have some other kind of agenda, like, oh, I have to get in all of these questions in the 90 minutes, and of course it went over 90 minutes anyway, then you're going to let them go back and forth, because that's actually more helpful to the American people and to viewers than just answering these pre-scripted questions, having 2 minutes and no back and forth. I mean, that to me would be the best type of debate. Almost like the debate that Hannity monitored between Governor DeSantis and Gavin Newsom back, you know, when it was like the Republican versus Democrat governors. And when they were going back and forth, Hannity actually let them go back and forth a couple of times in what I think was some really good exchanges and some helpful exchanges, because we want to know what is the difference and the worldview and policy view differences between the candidates. That's what's going to be the most helpful for the American people to actually decide, for those who are still in the undecided category, to say, well, let me actually hear from them. And one of the other commentaries as well was that there were a lot of people in polls and some of these focus groups after the fact that were on some of these networks, even like CNN, for example, that were saying, you know, the Democrats had been painting J.D. Vance as this, you know, kind of misogynist, chauvinist and creeper guy and weird dude and all of that. And he actually came across as very caring and compassionate and knowledgeable and intelligent. And I thought he overwhelmingly won the favorabilities category in that sense, because he did come across as very genuine. And in fact, at one point when the conversation was about gun control and what to do about school shootings, Tim Walz actually said that his son had been a witness to a shooting, and J.D. Vance said, wow, I didn't know that, and I am so sorry. And it was a very genuine moment, and you could tell that that was totally not scripted and was something that was just very very human and a very sort of genuine emotion that came through. But then that also, that whole topic led to, I think, one of the worst faux pas of the entire night of Tim Walz, because when he was talking about gun control and school shootings and all of that, he actually said, and he clearly misspoke, but as of today and this morning, when he's being asked by reporters, he's not clarifying. He's just totally ignoring it. But the moment of the night, I think, that everybody just sat back and said, what? Was when Tim Walz said, I was friends with school shooters. Listen to this. This is Cut 7.
So I've become friends with school shooters. I've seen it. Look, the NRA, I was an NRA guy for a long time. They used to.
I mean, what? Like, I think everybody, it went viral on social media immediately when people were saying, did I hear that right? And what exactly did he mean by that? And then, of course, there were all the memes putting him dancing, you know, next to the Nashville shooter and some other just really, you know, embarrassing content for Tim Walz. And hopefully he will clarify what he meant. But that also gets to some of the commentary about the content. And Ari Fleischer, who, of course, was a former White House press secretary, was talking on the news and to media after the fact, and just saying that Tim Walz clearly didn't seem prepared, because he hasn't been taking interviews, he hasn't been sitting down at press conferences, and so this was kind of his first primetime moment, and he clearly wasn't ready. Listen to Ari Fleischer. This is Cut 1.
He hasn't taken interviews. He doesn't do interviews. So therefore, this is really his first exposure to prime time. And that's why I think you're right. She's not ready. He's not ready to be our president and vice president. And that's what this election's all about.
And you can hear Hannity saying, you know, will this move the needle at all? And even though we don't have Ari's response to that, I'll respond to that by saying, I don't think that this necessarily moves the needle overall. But in some of the key districts, and this election is so close, I mean, people have constantly been asking me, who do you think is going to win? And do we trust the polls? You know, and all of these questions that everybody is thinking. And honestly, I think it is so close. I will not be surprised at this moment. And of course, we have all of October to go. We have a little over a month and things could change. We could get the October surprises, you know, all of that. But as we sit here today on Wednesday, October 2nd, I would genuinely not be surprised if it went either way. That is how close it is in a lot of these swing districts. I think that Trump still has some problems electorally in Georgia. Pennsylvania is looking better. We have what Scott Pressler is doing a lot of work on the ground to at least get people registered to vote. And so now in some of those very important counties, there are more registered Republicans than Democrats. That's favorable to Trump. But will they actually get out and vote? Or will Trump be able to get Pennsylvania, which of course didn't go to him ultimately in 2020 and is probably necessary in terms of the electoral math. And North Carolina is probably going to Kamala Harris. And so if you look at the swing states and you do the math, the margin of difference here is very, very slim. And it could end up, I mean, it could be surprising and it could end up a landslide either way, right? That's always a possibility. But more likely than that, I think it is razor thin margins. It's going to come down to who actually gets out and votes on Election Day. Of course, we already have some early voting that's starting, and that's always a concern in terms of turnout, and then of course counting the ballots and counting them fairly. So, you know, all of these things are incredibly important. And so, did last night actually change that? I think the biggest win was that J.D. Vance showed a different side of himself to the American people who were watching, and a lot of people tuned into this. There were also some really good clips, and of course, the media, including the mainstream media that a lot of the leftists watch, and a lot of these people who have seen J.D. Vance as, you know, the guy who said the childless cat lady comments, they'll probably have a different impression of him. That's a good thing. And I think he also was able to, with his demeanor and just being very genuine and frankly nice, but in a way that was very strong on policy, he was able to have a marked contrast between how his demeanor was versus Donald Trump's on the debate stage. And I don't know that Trump is necessarily going to like that, because a lot of the favorable media is going to then contrast him negatively to J.D. Vance. And, you know, we'll see how that goes over. But I think that ultimately actually is a good thing for Donald Trump. And it also shows, as one commentator from Red State mentioned on social media as well, this really showed that we can have a debate and we can have a debate on policy without going just to the hatred back and forth and a lot of the sort of rage tactics that we've all frankly become really used to over the last about decade that Donald Trump has been in politics. And I hope that this signals that maybe in the future we can get back to kind of a more civilized politic. And, you know, maybe that's just grandiose hope, but let's hope we can get there, because it was actually refreshing to hear that back and forth. And so so Walz also in the very, you know, end and the closing statements, Walz talked about the new way forward and the politics of joy. So let's play that clip. It's cut five.
Kamala Harris is bringing us a new way forward. She's bringing us a politics of joy. She's bringing real solutions for the middle class, and she's centering you at the heart of that, all the while asking everyone, join this movement. Make your voices heard. Let's look for a new day where everybody gets that opportunity and everybody gets a chance to thrive.
Yay, warm, fuzzy feelings. Okay, so let's contrast that to Vance's closing statement, which was very substantive, very, very sharp. This is cut six.
Well, I want to thank Governor Walz, you folks at CBS, and of course the American people for tuning in this evening. And one of the issues we didn't talk about was energy. And I remember when I was being raised by my grandmother, when she didn't have enough money to turn on the heat some nights because Ohio gets pretty cold at night and because money was often very tight. And I believe, as a person who wants to be your next vice president, that we are a rich and prosperous enough country where every American, whether they're rich or poor, ought to be able to turn on their heat in the middle of a cold winter night. That's gotten more difficult thanks to Kamala Harris's energy policies. I believe that whether you're rich or poor, you ought to be able to afford a nice meal for your family. That's gotten harder because of Kamala Harris's policies. I believe that whether you're rich or poor, you ought to be able to afford to buy a house. You ought to be able to live in safe neighborhoods. You ought to not have your communities flooded with fentanyl. And that, too, has gotten harder with Kamala because of Kamala Harris's policies. Now, I've been in politics long enough to do what Kamala Harris does when she stands before the American people and says that on day one, she's going to work on all these challenges I just listed. She's been the vice president for 3.5 years. Day one was 1,400 days ago, and her policies have made these problems worse. Now, I believe that we have the most beautiful country in the world. I meet people on the campaign trail who can't afford food, but have the grace and generosity to ask me how I'm doing and to tell me they're praying for my family. What that has taught me is that we have the greatest country, the most beautiful country, the most incredible people anywhere in the world. But they're not going to be able to achieve their full dreams with the broken leadership that we have in Washington. They're not going to be able to live their American dream if we do the same thing that we've been doing for the last 3.5 years. We need change. We need a new direction. We need a president who has already done this once before and did it well. Please vote for Donald Trump. And whether you vote for me or vote for Tim Walz, I just want to say I'm so proud to be doing this, and I'm rooting for you. God bless you, and good night.
All right. So do you want the politics of joy and the warm, fuzzy feelings and the vagary? Or do you want a team that actually knows how to get things done and has the proven track record? And I think that was ultimately the contrast of last night was do you want just the vibes or do you want substantive policy? And that's what it came down to. And that's why I give J.D. Vance the clear win. There were a few other people who said, oh, it was close, and they had, you know, some good back and forth, some kind of solid answers. But I think overall, J.D. Vance just proved that he is a very, very good debater, and he knows what he's saying. He knows substantive policy, and he made Donald Trump shine last night and really said that the 4 years under Donald Trump were better than the 4 years under Kamala Harris. So I give him the win. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning to talk about that and also what's going on in the Middle East.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I want to point to the clips that you just played because that captured one of the moments that stood out to me that Tim Walz was talking about how now is a time where we need Kamala Harris's steady hand of leadership, and especially with what we're seeing happening in the Middle East today, he threw out a lot of words that tried to distract away from Kamala Harris's record. Her and Joe Biden's policy on Iran was one word, don't. That was it. Clearly, Iran did not take that seriously. And why would they when Kamala Harris and Joe Biden opened the floodgates to make Iran have access to over $100 billion of funding that they didn't have access to under President Trump, which enabled them to fund Islamist terrorist groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, allowed them to gain hypersonic ballistic missile capability for the first time ever just earlier in 2023. Mm-hmm. And experts are saying now that Iran is likely to gain nuclear weapons capabilities potentially even before the next president takes office. J.D. Vance did a great job in contrasting that with making the very clear points about what President Trump's foreign policy resulted in. No new wars, de-escalated tensions, and he did the work that a president is supposed to do in engaging in direct diplomacy in order to accomplish that.
That was Tulsi Gabbard responding to the debate last night. And the very first question out of the gate was about the Middle East, and this coming as Iran fires nearly 200 missiles into Israel and that escalation that has taken place this week. So to talk about all of this and more, let's welcome in our good friend Joel Rosenberg, who is the editor-in-chief at All Israel News. And Joel, good morning. And first, I want to get your response to the debate last night and just the fact that the very first question was about the Middle East. That surprised me, and I think that was actually a good thing from CBS, given what's going on in the Middle East right now.
Jenna, it's great to be with you, and greetings from Washington. It's strange for me not to be in Israel right now with my people as we are in this head-to-head showdown with the Iranian regime. But yes, it was very important. This was the lead topic, and on a day where Iran had fired, as you say, almost 200 ballistic missiles at Israel. And what's the Biden-Harris administration doing? It's trying to put Israel in a headlock to get us to not respond. You know, the Biden and Harris have been demanding that Israel accept a 21-day ceasefire in Lebanon, except in the statement that they made last week, right, they didn't even end the word Hezbollah. So who would we be ceasing fire with? Oh, that would be the people that have been firing 10,000 missiles at us since October 8th of last year. But Netanyahu went the exact opposite direction. Rather than accepting this bizarre and ridiculous demand from our closest ally to surrender, to stop firing, to stop defending ourselves, Netanyahu went for the jugular, right? He decapitated the entire Hezbollah leadership in the last, taking out, of course, at the top, Hassan Nasrallah, who was the wicked, satanic leader of Hezbollah for 32 years. And Israel took out 18 of the top 18 Hezbollah leaders. And with the whole, you know, explosives-laden pager and walkie-talkie operation, took out or at least wounded and disabled 4,000 senior and mid-level operatives in Hezbollah. This is tremendous. But Iran is humiliated, and they are attacking us directly. And yet the Biden-Harris administration is demanding that Israel do nothing. In fact, they, as you saw, Jenna, senior officials were leaking in the early hours after Israel took out Nasrallah how furious they were that they weren't informed, that Israel did this without our, you know, our permission. We don't know what's going on. So Walz's defense of this administration and of Harris was weak. But what are they supposed to say? They're the worst ally you could possibly have in a time of war. I mean, this is really serious. Israel is having to go this alone on seven different fronts, even though we Israelis just killed the very people that killed hundreds and hundreds of Americans in Iraq, in Lebanon, in the Beirut bombings in 1983, the Marine bombings. Like, how come the United States didn't bring these terrorists to justice over the last 40 years? Like, and so when we do it, we're criticized. We're told to stand down. We're told to de-escalate. Wow, you are really getting a clear picture of two entirely different philosophies and approaches towards foreign policy and national security. And I agree. I didn't see the whole debate. But everything I've seen suggests that J.D. Vance was very, very impressive. The fact that that liberal media commentators and even a number of Democrats were praising his performance and showing disappointment in Walz, it tells you a lot.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, a lot to unpack there. But first, I mean, last time I checked, Israel is its own sovereignty. And yes, you know, has allies like the United States that clearly under Kamala Harris's leadership are failing Israel and, you know, telling them somehow that they're the aggressor and going along with that whole media narrative. But one of the things that was very evident on the debate stage last night, especially in the middle of, you know, this day with so much news and this heightened escalation of the war going on in the Middle East, is that it doesn't seem like the Biden, Harris, Walz whole team and side really has a comprehensive plan or strategy or policy around Israel. And you contrast that with what J.D. Vance very clearly articulated and how he talked about Donald Trump's first 4 years. And it seems like if anybody is paying attention, you know, regardless of party and partisanship and all of that, I mean, don't Americans want strength and leadership and people who actually have policy in a direction?
They do. They do. And yet Israel is being left out to dry. The Biden-Harris team is not doing what a true ally should do, which is make it very clear that America is with Israel 100% and tell Israel, finish the job. You know, I wrote a column this morning for All Israel News, which people can find at allisrael.com, called October Surprise. And I basically say it's time for Israel to decapitate the Iranian regime and take out Iran's nuclear and oil facilities. Iran's regime has never paid a price for any of the terror against America, against Israel, against our Sunni Arab allies. I mean, yes, there were good sanctions, economic sanctions that the Trump team put on during those years. Yes, President Trump, to his credit, tore up the Iran nuclear deal, which was a total giveaway, and he stopped sending billions and billions of dollars to Iran, which Biden then came in and tried to renegotiate the stupid Iran nuclear deal that just paves a pathway for Iran to get to nuclear weapons anyway. And then Iran has, Biden has already helped release about $100 billion for the Iranian regime. So, but the point is, the Iranian regime has either been appeased by the Democrats, or there were, you know, strong economic sanctions and a number of things that Trump did. But if you look over the last 40 years, since the Iranians took over the U.S. embassy in Tehran and held Americans hostage for 444 days, or when they murdered 241 Marines at the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, and on and on and on, the killings of American soldiers in Iraq and so forth, as well as killing Israelis, the Iranian regime has never actually paid a serious price. And I think the gloves are off. I think that what's happening is the Israeli government right now, which was meeting much of the night in a closed-door security cabinet meeting, I think they're actually contemplating, is this the moment? I believe it is. I believe it is that this is the moment in which the Israeli military should begin decapitation strikes against Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and attacking Iran's oil facilities and nuclear facilities, because you can't let a country as dangerous as Iran keep attacking Israel, America, and our Sunni Arab allies with impunity. We thought we could manage this problem. We thought America would deal with this problem. But clearly Biden and Harris and Waltz would never. They haven't, and they won't deal decisively with this problem. And we're in this war. Are we going to accept a ceasefire and then pick this up again 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now? I mean, these people have sworn to annihilate Israel and then annihilate America. American leaders don't seem ready, willing, or able, at least under the Democrats, to do anything about it. I don't fault Trump for what he did, because he was putting enormous pressure, and I think the Iranians were finally about to fold. But when Biden and Harris released all the pressure and started shipping money back over to there and released the sanctions and so forth, it just emboldened Iran. So I think Iran does not expect an actual real significant response from Israel, because no one has ever made the Iranian regime pay a real price for the last 40, almost 50 years. I think that's the October surprise that's needed right now.
I'm speaking with Joel Rosenberg, who is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News, and you can find that at allisrael.com. And his column that is on the splash page here is titled October Surprise, It's Time for Israel to Decapitate Iranian Regime, Destroy Its Oil Refineries, Nuclear Facilities. And so as we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of that horrific terror attack against Israel on October 7th, next week, I think this war and this conflict has been extended far beyond what anyone anticipated initially. And do you see that potentially changing, at least in the strategy, and maybe how Iran will think, they might actually suffer some other consequences from the United States if the election turns to Donald Trump winning?
Well, if President Trump is reelected and J.D. Vance comes in with him, I think they will give Israel all the encouragement, all the weapons, all the support needed to to win this war and win it decisively. I really do. I don't think there's ever been a more pro-Israel president in American history than President Trump. And admittedly, President Trump, you know, is not happy about war in the Middle East. He said, you know, we need to bring it to an end. But his way of ending it isn't to put Israel into a hammerlock, you know, a headlock, and to restrict weapons from it. He's saying, get the job done and then get it over with. And that's a different message. It's an entirely different message. And I would say, you know, you just mentioned that next Monday is the one-year anniversary of October 7th. Honestly, Jenna, I would be looking that day is the day that Israel will unleash a massive attack on Iran, the likes of which we've never seen before. Iran's incredibly vulnerable, but because they've never paid a price, they don't think they will. If there was ever a day that Israelis would want to see that regime suffer justice, you know, it's not just suffer. We don't want the Iranian people to suffer. Let's be clear. Prime Minister Netanyahu just sent a message, a video message to the Iranian people. We're with you. We hate your regime, and you do too. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. But the Iranian people will be rejoicing in the streets if we take out this regime, if we bring this regime to justice. And I think the next few days are critical. It's a test, though. It's a test for Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government, because the pressure of the largest superpower, the only superpower in the world, the American government, to withstand the pressure, I mean, the pressure is enormous, and to withstand that pressure from President Biden, Vice President Harris, and the entire senior leader of the United States and say, no, I'm sorry, we respect you, we love you as Americans, but you're wrong. This is our existence on the line. We have to take these steps for our security. And if you're not going to help us, we're certainly not going to let you restrain us. So I think these next days are critical, and we need every Christian in America and around the world to be praying for us. Because when we say pray for the peace of Jerusalem, yeah, nobody wants war. But when war comes, the way to restore peace is not to give up. It's to win. And that's what Israel's committed to doing.
Yeah, so well said. And we do need to be praying for the peace of Jerusalem. And you're right. I mean, justice often involves consequences. And that's why I support Israel. And I certainly support Israel defending herself. And I certainly don't support what the mainstream media has done in terms of trying to position this as if, you know, Israel needs to just stand back and sit back and say, okay, fine, you know, we'll take it. And I wish that the Harris administration that's currently in office would be stronger on this, but hopefully we'll see something different come November. But Joel Rosenberg, always appreciate your comments. We are praying for you and your family as well, along with the nation of Israel. And again, you can find Joel's column at allisrael.com. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If ending babies' lives in their mother's womb isn't heartbreaking enough, the Biden-Harris administration punishes those who protect life, including up to 10 years in jail. In a shocking stance, the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, supports infanticide, meaning the death of newborns. When will this madness end? Preborn's network of clinics is positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country, on standby to protect and love mothers facing unplanned pregnancies. By introducing a woman to her baby through ultrasound and showering her with God's love, her baby's chance at life doubles. But they can't do it without our help. If you are pro-life, please consider a donation of any size to support the mission of Preborn. All gifts are tax deductible and will help defend the defenseless. One ultrasound is just $28, or five ultrasounds is $140. $5,000 will sponsor ultrasounds for Preborn's entire network for a full day. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR, preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, nearly 50,000 members of the International Longshoremen's Association, or the ILA, are on strike as of yesterday at midnight. So this would have been Monday night going into Tuesday against the nation's East and Gulf Coast ports. This coming from CNN, choking off the flow of many America's imports and exports in what could be the country's most disruptive work stoppage in decades. And this coming as Biden is refusing to enforce the Taft-Hartley Act, which would require port workers to keep things running while negotiations continue. I think it's about at 80 days, and the union has been accused of breaking labor laws with the strike and their negotiation tactics. So all of this is coming in. I think America is wondering, is Biden even coherent? Does he even know what's going on? Does he know that he should be invoking this? Well, joining us now is Jim Nels, who is a supply chain expert, to discuss this more. So, Jim, how much of a risk does this actually pose to the United States in terms of our imports and exports, especially as the holiday season is right around the corner?
It's a big deal, Jeanette. Good morning. Thank you for having me. This is costing the U.S. economy $5 billion per day, according to J.P. Morgan. And the thing is, for every day the strike happens, it's going to take 1 week to recover, meaning if this strike goes for 7 days, it's going to take up to 2 months to recover from the strike. And it's a big deal. These ports, 68% of exports go through these ports. 56% of imports go through these ports. And that's about $600 billion, according to 2023 numbers. So it's a lot of things. The first thing we're going to see, Jenna, is we're going to see fruits and vegetables not showing up on the shelves because they're going to rot while they wait on ships or they sit in the ports. Then we're going to start to see things like cars not being available. We'll see consumer and industrial goods not available. We'll see pharmaceuticals not available, and that's going to start crippling the economy. So I think we're going to see a little bit of inflation. I think we're going to see the unemployment rate go up because this doesn't impact just the workers on the docks or on strike. It's going to impact over 100,000 other union members who drive the trucks, who work in the warehouses, who stock our grocery shelves. They're going to be put out of work. And the head of the union for the ILA doesn't care. He has said, quote, "I will cripple the U.S. economy in order to prove my point." And he's doing that right now.
Wow. And this doesn't seem like it's a very good thing for Democrats heading into the last month of the election. And so why wouldn't Joe Biden invoke the Taft-Hartley Act to keep everything running while negotiations are continuing?
So there are two things. One, we've never invoked the Taft-Hartley Act. And the head of the union, a man named Harold Diggett, said, if they do invoke the act, we'll respond, but we will do a work slowdown. And so it would be the same thing. The other thing is, I'm starting to wonder, maybe Joe Biden's a little bit more cognizant than we think he is. And this is his final middle finger to the Democrat Party for kicking off the ticket. And he's like, I'm not going to get involved, and I'll let Camilla deal with this.
That's actually an interesting thought, and he's just sort of checked out to the beach in California for the waning days of his one-term presidency. And if that's the case, then it is so terrible that Biden would care more about his own personal feelings toward the Democrat Party than he would about America, which he claimed the reason that he stepped down and isn't running is because he's putting the country first, when clearly he's not. And so if Biden was operating the way that he should and in the best interests of America, what should be happening right now?
Well, if you look back to last year when we had a potential railroad strike and we had a potential West Coast dock worker strike, he sent in not Mayor Pete, because Mayor Pete was on maternity leave. He sent in his acting Secretary of Commerce, and that person helped to negotiate a deal, and they got a deal done. But now that it's an election year, they don't want to get involved. Remember, Joe Biden actually walked the picket line with the UAW. He was the first president to ever do that. Kamala Harris is in a pickle right now because does she, you know, appease to the 45,000 dock workers, or does she appease to the American public who is going to be hurt by this? And that's what's really going to happen here. We're going to see an uptick in inflation. You're going to see empty store shelves. I don't know if you saw the videos and the pictures of lines at Costco yesterday. but people are freaking out. They're thinking that this is going to be COVID all over again. I don't think it's going to get that bad, but the government has basically checked out. They've washed their hands of this, which is really a sin for the American people.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Jim Nels, who is a supply chain economist. And Jim, you know, as you were describing how much time it's going to take for the recovery, and obviously, you know, this has only been going on for 2 days now, but even if we extend it a week, then that's still 2 months of recovery. My first thought was, you know, I remember just a couple of years ago when there was a toilet paper shortage, when there were, you know, there were car shortages. I mean, I remember my cousin and her family who were trying to get a car couldn't get one for a solid year in the aftermath of all of the issues that happened during COVID. So are people wise to stock up on some of those necessities, or, you know, if they're considering making that kind of a purchase, like a new vehicle or, you know, some of those things, that they're going to do that now just in case?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would run out and buy a car tomorrow if you're looking at cars, but, you know, I always recommend that people have a week's worth of food and water on hand, some extra toilet paper, et cetera. You should always have that just in case. I mean, the people of Asheville, North Carolina are realizing that right now because of the hurricane. But do we need to start worrying about cars and other things? I'm not so sure yet. But if you're in the market for a car, I would wait a couple of months and let the prices come back down, because the price is going to go up here in the short term.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, it's just with everything going on, not just with all of the problems in the economy and inflation and all of these things that we've been talking about, you know, for the last year or more under Biden and Harris, but now with this problem just continuing to escalate it, you know, this is a really scary time for the American people. And so with, as you mentioned, the head of the ILA saying, you know, that he intends to cripple the U.S. economy, does that project that these negotiations will be intentionally dragged out? Or are you anticipating that, you know, there is at least a potential opportunity to get this resolved, you know, within the next couple of days so that we don't have some of these more disastrous forecasts?
So my people are telling me that this is going to go a minimum of 2 weeks, probably at least three, before they start having serious negotiations. The head of the ILA, again, Harold Diggett, he is a poor negotiator because he only thinks about tomorrow. He doesn't think about next week. So he's willing to put over 100,000 other union members out of work in order to prove his point for his union. And that's not how you negotiate. What he should be doing, they're negotiating over two things. One, they want a 77% pay raise, which, God, I would love to have that. And then number two, they want no automation or even semi-automation in the ports, meaning they don't even want a camera to read the license plates of trucks that come in and out of the port. They want to hire two union guys and to do that and pay them $50 an hour to write down a license plate on a clipboard. What he should be negotiating for is saying, listen, I understand that automation is coming. What I want you carriers to do is to guarantee that anyone who is displaced by automation gets another union job with one of your other companies, and that job will be protected for X number of years. He's not thinking long term. He's thinking short term, and he's thinking headlines, and that's a mistake for him. That's a mistake for his people, and it's a mistake for America.
I'm speaking with Jim Nels, who's a supply chain economist. And, you know, last night during the debate, Tim Walz very clearly said, you know, I'm a union guy. And obviously, you know, coming from the Democrat Party, they pride themselves kind of on being big union people. And so is that potentially a contrast to what Kamala Harris currently is supporting, at least in terms of the administration that's not really getting involved? Or how do you see that playing out in terms of the election for the next 4 weeks?
Well, I think Tim Walz is still staring like a dog in the headlights right now from the debate last night. But Kamala's actually not doing a bad job on this. It pains me to say that. She's staying out of it, which is probably the smartest thing she can do. Now, Donald Trump, on the other hand, is wading into this, and he's taking a position which I think is going to be good for his base. But Harris, again, is really saying nothing other than we want the collective bargaining to work, blah, blah, blah. So like everything else that she's done since she's become the candidate, she's not taking a position. She's not talking about it. And no one's going to ask her about it, which is really a shame for the American people, because we should hear what she actually believes about this in order to make an informed decision.
Yeah, well, she's been avoiding all of the press conferences, and, you know, hopefully there are some reporters who would ask her about it, but she hasn't actually given them the opportunity. And I love the Fox News ticker that I get every morning as one of those push alerts that's like, it's now been 68 days, it's now been 72 days since Kamala Harris has had a press conference.
Exactly.
And, you know, and so I don't think she's given anybody those opportunities, probably because she doesn't have answers. I mean, what is she going to say? And especially when Joe Biden is kind of handicapping her response in that sense. I mean, she's being put in a very difficult position and doesn't seem to have the strategy or you know, the wherewithal to be able to navigate that appropriately. And so so on the other hand, you know, with this guy who you've mentioned, who's the head of the ILA, who is not being very strategic, do you think that the union workers are going to be dissatisfied with him, or you know, where is the positioning in terms of, you know, his leadership on the negotiations overall? Could they end up saying, you know, hey, you're not looking long term, listen to somebody like you and say, you know, maybe we need to have bring in somebody else to negotiate all this?
No, because he talks like a fortune cookie, right? So he talks in headlines, which the uninformed will love, right? He says things like, one of the largest carriers, a company called MSC, is bigger than Amazon. And people get really upset about that. But if you actually do the research, if you have Google on your phone or something, you can look it up. Amazon's quarterly net income is $13 billion. MSC's quarterly income is $100 million. So Amazon is much bigger than this company, but no one fact checks him on this. He says these companies are making billions and billions of dollars in profit. Actually, no. The average steamship company makes about 6.25% net margin. That means that they make 6 cents on every dollar. Coca-Cola, for example, makes 20 cents on every dollar. So they're not making extraordinary profits. But again, he talks in headlines, he talks like a fortune cookie, and that's what feeds his base. And they love it, and they're willing to do this because he's convinced them that they're going to get an 80% pay raise.
Wow, isn't that just sad how the headlines and the talking points that genuinely lack cohesive strategy and substance are often what motivates the base? And that goes for both sides. I mean, people really need to understand the issues. And this is, again, why I love the radio format, because we can do a deeper dive into some of these things rather than just kind of the top line and say, okay, you know, let's bounce from one story to another and actually really understand what's going on. And I appreciate your time, Jim Nels. And, you know, is this also impacting in any way the hurricane recovery in so many states as we're seeing? I mean, the mainstream media, shockingly, isn't really covering a lot of that. And I know so many in our AFR family have been impacted by the hurricane. I mean, this is, you know, where a lot of our radio network is. And, you know, we've been following this very closely.
Yes, it does impact us because two of the largest importers on the East Coast are Home Depot and Lowe's. And think about what you need when you recover from a hurricane. You need plywood, you need nails, you need screws, you need all those things. And those things are not coming into our ports right now because this gentleman and his people decided to go on strike. So it's definitely hurting the people of Asheville, North Carolina, and the other people along the East Coast who are hurt by this hurricane.
Wow. And our prayers go out to them. And I know that there's so much that the state of Florida, thankfully, with Governor DeSantis, I'm so very proud of my home state and the preparedness here and sending, you know, so many supplies and personnel to other states to help with that recovery. And just in the last couple of minutes I have with you, Jim, let's turn really quickly to Donald Trump's response. I know we had mentioned it, but, you know, what is he advocating for? And do you agree with his strategy?
I do. I mean, he wants this settled. I mean, he's a deal maker, right? So he wants the two sides to sit down and come up with something. And I think Trump would support what I believe should happen is, again, let's find a way to give them a living wage. Trump has said the only reason they're striking is because of the inflation that was brought on by the Biden-Harris regime. And he's right. But now they feel that they need more money to make up for the money they lost over the last 4 years. But also, they need to be thinking about not tomorrow, but next week, next month, next year, next decade. And they need to embrace automation, not fight it. And they need to then find new jobs for these other people. And if you don't think automation matters, let me tell you this one thing. China is working on 4 deepwater ports in Mexico right now, 2 on the West Coast, 2 on the East Coast. Guess who's, and they're going to be fully automated. Guess who's going to supplant Los Angeles and places like New York and places like Savannah as the big ports in the North America? It's going to be Mexico, led by China.
Wow. And, you know, maybe this is also where Donald Trump was right, that we need to return a lot more manufacturing back to our shores rather than relying so much on the imports. You know, we can export, but we need to have pharmaceuticals ready. We need to have, you know, manufacturing here. We need to do a lot more that is American made. But Jim Nels, always really appreciate it. We're already out of time, and you can let me know on either social media or reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net, what you thought about the debate. And we'll be back with more tomorrow. Have a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.